So in the following, I'm very excited to talk about new lessons about hydrodynamics from gravity. So it's a talk somewhere in between the string theory, high energy physics, and strong gravity communities. Most of the results that I'll talk about were published in this paper, but I will make contact also with other works by myself and other people. So let me start with the motivation. And the motivation is a question: why are we as a community gathered in this room interested in hydrodynamics? So the reason why people doing GR are interested in hydrodynamics is because gravity under certain circumstances behaves like hydrodynamic theory. To mention a few things, a few words, I have in mind membrane paradigm, fluid gravity duality, a follow-up fluid gravity duality, which is black folds, and recent studies of gravity and turbulence, so something that Lewis was involved in, and a few other people from here. So the second motivation for studying hydrodynamics and holography, second motivation to study hydrodynamics is holography. Making contact with the physics of strongly coupled coagulant plasma in heavy ion collisions at RIC and LHC, to mention a few words that are familiar to you, the famous calculation of the shear viscosity, eta over s equals 1 over 4 pi, the question whether there is a lower, whether this is a lower bound or not. So that's something that many of you worked on here. The discovery of new transport phenomena, something that I will tell you about maybe later on. And the question about the cavitation, whether it's relevant or not relevant for this thing over here. So this is something that is known or has been studied more or less extensively with a few exceptions. What I'm going to talk about today is something that is brand new, that is based on a statement that gravity, in particular gravity in ADS, UV completes certain hydrodynamic theories. So this statement allows us to study thermalization in strongly coupled field theories and transition to hydrodynamics, which is referred nowadays as hydrodynamization. I will tell you why later on. And my talk will try to shed light on these processes by understanding the relation between hydrodynamic degrees of freedom and other degrees of freedom that live there in holographic plasmas, so the plasmas that are described by gravity via the gauge gravity duality. So in order to get everybody on a common ground, let me tell you what I mean by relativistic uncharged hydrodynamics. So what is the modern way of thinking about hydrodynamics? So the way we think about hydrodynamics is as an effective field theory that describes the slow evolution of conserved currents in collective media that in some sense are close to equilibrium. And I put quotation marks at close to equilibrium because it turns out that it's not obvious what it actually means. As any effective field theory, hydrodynamics is based on the idea of the gradient expansion, degrees of freedom, the relevant degrees of freedom, so the degrees of freedom that survive in hydrodynamic theory, the infrared degrees of freedom, are always local energy density, or alternatively the temperature, and local flow velocity. So this is one quantity. Flow velocity in 3+1 dimensions, there are like 4 quantities, right? But it is normalized, so actually we have just 3 independent components. And then equations of motion are conservation equations for the stress tensor, where the stress tensor is systematically expanded in gradients. So we have one free index here, so we have four equations for four variables that makes a closed set. So that is a signal that what I'm talking about here makes actually sense. And now, one lesson that we drew from holography is that this expansion of the stress tensor in gradients has to be done in a systematic manner. I mean, we have to include a priori all possible gradient terms, and only then the microscopic theory decides whether all of them are present there or not. So let me start the story about expanding the stress tensor in gradients. So we start with the stress tensor that is basically locally boosted and locally dilated, the stress tensor of a perfect fluid, so a plasma this is the locally dilated and boosted static plasma stress tensor, right? So this is the plasma in equilibrium, but now the temperature and local velocity depends on where you are. And then on top of this, we add all available gradient correction. In the first order in gradients, we have just two possible gradient structures. One is the shear tensor that is multiplied by the scalar quantity called the shear viscosity. The other one is the divergence of the velocity that is multiplied by the bulk viscosity. And then we can keep going and consider terms having two and more gradients. There is a certain rationale in doing so. I may return to this later on in my talk. So this is the consideration that is entirely based on the symmetries, right? So we don't need to know anything about microscopics, right? We just write all the possible terms that are there in the expansion. And now the microscopics comes with an input. So we need to know the equation of state. So how, say, pressure depends on the energy density that we obtain from thermodynamics. And then we need to know the transport properties. In particular, we need to know the shear viscosity. We need the bulk viscosity. And then depending on what is the microscopic theory, then we'll get different form of these quantities. For example, for conformal filters that I will consider, the equation of state is epsilon equals 3 times p. And the bulk viscosity vanishes because of the tracelessness of the stress tensor. So obviously, we know the form of the stress tensor by doing holography or kinetic theory or perturbative gauge theories. We know something about the transport properties that come from the microscopics. By doing lattice or considering static black holes, we know the equation of state. But then the question is, when does it apply, right? Like this describes the dynamics, right, of a liquid from some moment onwards. But when is this moment? Like when does it happen? So naively, one might be inclined to associate hydrodynamic regime with small gradients, right? We do this looks like an expansion on top of equilibrium configuration, and this expansion is good when the gradients are small. So that's the naive take on hydrodynamics. However, that's not the way we actually should think about effective field theories. The better way to think about effective field theories is to understand hydrodynamic modes as low energy degrees of freedom. And of course, there are also other degrees of freedom in a fluid. And then the topic of my talk is to use holography to elucidate the imprint of these other degrees of freedom living in a fluid on the behavior of hydrodynamics, when it applies, and what are its properties. Any questions so far? Yeah.
The heat flow, the heat conductivity, the heat back, because it's not really related to the gradients, but shouldn't it be there on the first approximation too?
I think that you will have when you consider a conserved charge on top of what I have here that I don't have. I don't think you have a heat flow if you don't have a conserved charge, right? In this case.
But if you're talking only about the energy momentum tensor up to first order in the gradients, the heat flow should be there, right?
It's a relativistic field theory. I wrote you like everything that is there. That's it. I consider a case in which the fluid is at rest. So the velocity is defined by the vector that is the boost that is needed to put the fluid at rest. And I don't think there you have a heat flow. So you can put a fluid at rest, but for example, the fluid might be at rest, but then the question is what's happening with the charge, right? So I think like then, yeah.
I don't think it's the story of the frame. But how do you choose your frame?
So I choose a frame in which there is no momentum flow.
No, there is a frame in which it's okay to focus on the stress energy density. There is always a heat flow, and there is a thermal conductivity. So those things that exist in angle four, or you know, and you can compute them using holography. People did that. So I don't think.
But you're saying that that's a gauge dependent statement?
No, it's not gauge dependent. So there is a way. I have to look at, to remind myself. But there is a heat current, and so you just write down kind of along the lines how you would have a charge, except it would be a heat current.
You mean you put the you put the gradient in temperatures and answer ask the question what's happening?
A time-like direction first. Then you write the equation, say, you go to special relativity in which you can say, like, this is time and space. Then it makes sense to talk about a heat flux, and it should be obvious in that sort of frame.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it also boils down to how we define U. This is based around choosing Mandel frame to define U. So
that's
U is defined by the system with no heat current. So in a sense, it's just the definition of U.
So that was my first. That was my first.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean necessarily that it will become moving, that you have a rest frame. Because
yes.
The heat flow is defined perpendicular to the vector flow, to the velocity.
Yes, so we define U so that.
I'm not sure this is relevant for the rest of my talk. Yeah, I'm not sure this is relevant. Yeah. So good. So let me continue. So I told you a little bit about hydrodynamics, the way people think these days about hydrodynamics. What I mean, people are holographists and also nuclear theorists to some extent. So now let me tell you about the holography. And holography will be the microscopic theory that allows you to calculate the things like transfer properties or the equation of state. And from applicational perspective, holography, in particular ADS-CFT, is a tool for computing correlation functions in certain strongly coupled gauge theories. And for simplicity, I will consider the simplest case, like the most rudimentary case, in which I'll be just solving Einstein's equations with the negative cosmological constant. And it turns out that different solutions of these equations correspond to states in a dual conformal field theory that are characterized with different values of the stress tensor. So this is the artist's vision of anti-distributed spacetime. And now if you look at the behavior of fields at infinity close to the boundary, then from this you can obtain what's the value of the stress tensor given the solution everywhere. So the simplest solution, of course, is vacuum ADS. And then the solution that is dual to the thermal deconfined state of a conformal field theory is ADS Schwarzschild black hole, which is described by the following metric. I'm using here the ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, which are regular at the horizon. And then the thermodynamics of the spacetime, the thermodynamics of this black hole is at the same time a thermodynamics of dual field theory. In particular, by looking at the gravity solution, we can obtain lessons about the thermodynamic behavior of strongly coupled conformal field theories, and then maybe learn something about strongly coupled coagulant plasma. One lesson is visible already over here. In particular, if you look at the free energy or entropy, it turns out that the result predicted by the gravity is order one, the result predicted at zero coupling, right? So strongly coupled result and weakly coupled result for thermodynamic quantities do not differ that much. So that was one clue for QCD community that is already seen in this simple example. I'll be talking about things that are more complicated. I'll be talking about non-equilibrium physics. And the simplest example of non-equilibrium physics that you can imagine, apart from hydrodynamics that I already told you about, are small amplitude perturbations on top of a holographic plasma. So this is the form of the thermal stress tensor. And then on top of this, you add a perturbation that is small. The thermal stress tensor is homogeneous and it's time independent. So we can go to the Fourier space and we can characterize our modes by the momentum they carry and by the frequency. And dissipation, which in the gravity picture is associated with the presence of the horizon, leads to frequencies with complex omega. And we're considering perturbation of the stress sensor. So there are different channels depending on which combinations of the indices we take. And in a particular channel, which is called, for obvious reasons, the sound channel, these frequencies look the following. So the first thing we see is that, indeed, they have imaginary parts. Typically, so for each momentum, there is an infinite number of modes. So these modes persist. So that's one thing. Then typically the frequencies of order of t, that means that typically these modes dissipate over a time scale of inverse of the temperature. However, there is a single family of modes such that as the momentum goes to zero, the dissipation and also propagation go to zero. And these are actually the modes which are slowly evolving and slowly dissipating, which are called hydrodynamic sound waves, right? It has the name, the sound channel. And all the rest are far from equilibrium modes, which are dampened over typical timescale that goes like 1 over t. So now, if you go to heavy ion collision experiments, and if you look at the equilibration timescales that people have there, this timescale is of order of 0.25 femtometers per C. The temperature at the moment of applicability of hydrodynamics is 50 MeV. And it turns out that this product is of order 1, precisely in this sense, which actually is a new lesson obtained from holography, that equilibrating over such a short timescale is not a terribly outrageous idea. Of course, here I'm talking about small amplitude perturbation. Creation of the coagulon plasma in heavy ion collisions is not a small perturbation in any sense. Nevertheless, you can also do this study at the nonlinear level, and you will find something very similar using the gravity. Very good. So now we already arrive at the first lesson that comes from this simple picture. In order for hydrodynamics to work, we need all the other degrees of freedom to relax, right? So we have, imagine that we create some non-equilibrium state that is a small amplitude perturbation of an equilibrium plasma. Then we imagine that there's a mixture of all these modes appearing, right? And then if we wait for long enough, these modes that are dampened over 1 over t will be gone effectively, right? Like they will be negligibly small. And then what's gonna be left are these modes, right? So that's basically the lesson that can be drawn from this. So it's a non-trivial lesson. I mean, like it was appreciated only very recently that this is the case. And there is a second lesson that, to the best of my knowledge, also hasn't been anticipated. That let me make a simple observation. No matter for how long one waits, there will be always remnants of these other non-equilibrium degrees of freedom. They are exponentially dampened. So from a physicist's point of view, they will be negligible over a timescale of 1 over t, or maybe 2 over t, something of that order, right? But from a mathematical point of view, they will be never non-zero. They will be always different than 0. So this means that hydrodynamic gradient expansion cannot converge, right? Because if the approximation that is a momentum expansion converges, that would mean that from a certain timescale onwards, hydrodynamics would be everything that is there in the system. However, in the system there are also other things that are not hydro. Hence, this expansion cannot converge. So, in the rest of my talk, I'll basically elucidate these two points by using examples obtained from the numerical solutions of Einstein's equations. So, any questions so far?
Usually we talk about the radius, but
my statement is radius converges to 0.
Which is, strictly speaking, is not an immediate consequence of the fact that there are some modes.
But the point of my talk is to use holography to prove the...
Just because I have other modes in, say, as poles in my correlation functions, that doesn't necessarily imply that... Normally, I would have thought that the radius of convergence would be to the next massive thing, but you were saying that that's not.
No, because these other guys will be never non-zero, right? So no matter for how long you wait, they will be always there.
But let
me tell you one thing. So I will present a model that...
In some sense, you're trying to say that any effective field theory has zero radius of convergence in gradient expansion.
Until
new degrees of freedom can even not captured by the OT, which is
possible. So, for example, if you do the Payen Lagrangian, right, then it would also have a zero radius of convergence because it doesn't care. I mean, it doesn't have included the first massive meson, right?
Correct, and I encoded the integration out of my
but if your description converges, I mean, you have to consider arbitrary high orders, right? And then if it converges, then it means that it describes the whole physics. So that's the whole point, that it doesn't.
If I have a mass scale, I fail to see why
No, but I think what you're saying is an interesting comment, but it doesn't apply because when you integrated it correctly, that means that for keeping like a finite number of terms, right? We talked about this, I think, on Monday or Tuesday. If you have like a finite number of terms and you consider, say, like 10 terms in a gradient expansion or 20, right? Then 20 is always a better approximation than 10, right? But you have to go to smaller and smaller, say, momenta or gradients, right? And if you, my statement is that if you include everything, then this doesn't converge. But also, this is the statement in perturbative quantum field theory, right? It also doesn't converge. Precisely of this reason.
Maybe somebody would explain to me that why, you know, if I have an effective field theory later, or if there is an effective field theory with a gap, then why any process by studying within an effective field theory a process at an energy scale lessens a gap? Why would my effective field theory not be convergent? That's not the. I mean, I agree with you that as long as the processes I study are above the mass gap in the theory, then that's like going outside of the radius of convergence.
Yeah, let's discuss it afterwards. I will show you what I mean in this context, okay? Yeah. This, maybe one has to say that what I'm talking about here is a classical effective field theory, right? So maybe that's...
So the expansion parameter is the k, so it seems that it's different regular field theory because the expansion parameter.
But the moment that she's talking about is going to cause the zero radius of convergence somehow have a k equals zero finite matter. It's not like I would agree with you. Then I would say that you simply don't have a well-defined. You didn't integrate out properly. You have light motion, so that's why there is a zero radius of convergence. But the modes that cause this, which random have. I don't
want to steal this. But the problem is that you're not supposed to go like directly to zero, right? You always have to stay like slightly outside zero, right?
Even slightly outside zero, the mode is positive. We're going to say it's the first quasi-normal mode, which is mass. At k equals zero, it has omega 1 over t. So it doesn't have omega equals zero. But that's what's confusing to me. Why is that mode causes...
But the problem here is that previously you excited... It's almost impossible to not excite this mode. Like that's my statement. But I will let me keep going and I'll tell you how it arises. So I made two strong statements, and some of you might say that they're unjustified. So let me show you a model that is solvable via holography, via gravity, that allows to justify these two statements. So I will show you top-down calculations in certain gauge theories that justify these two statements about the applicability of hydrodynamics. And about the radius of convergence of hydrodynamics. So good. So the simplest model, to the best of my knowledge, in which one can test these ideas is the so-called Boose-invariant flow with no transverse expansion. The Boose-invariant flow, for some of you, might be also known under the name of the Bjorken flow. It was invented by Bjorken in 1982 or 83. So this Boose-invariant flow is a one-dimensional expansion of matter, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be hydrodynamics. It can be also far from equilibrium physics. So if we have a one-dimensionally expanding matter, that means that physics depend on the position where we are along the expansion axis, right? And when we observe, right? So on expansion position along the expansion axis and lap frame time. So if we were to solve this model using gravity, that would mean that we have to solve PDEs in 2+1 dimensions, which is hard. We didn't want to do this. And then the Bjorken dynamics saves the day because actually, because of the additional assumption of Boose invariance, the physics does not depend on the lap frame time and lap frame position independently, but it depends on a particular combination of them that is Boose invariant. Right? And then it actually turns out that the dynamics now depend only on the field theory dynamics depend only on one variable. And then the bulk depends on two variables, and that makes it solvable. That allows us to do wonderful things using gravity. So now, the last thing that you perhaps need to know is that the stress tensor for conformal field theory is entirely expressed in terms of the local energy density. And now if you think about this one-dimensionally expanding plasma, so this is the expansion axis, this is the time, so this is the toy model of quadrupole plasma in heavy ion collision. Let me not dwell into more details. For small values of tau, you are in this regime where you expect the this is the collision point. For small values of tau, you are in this far from equilibrium regime. And if you wait for long enough, then you approach hydrodynamics and you keep going with your evolution. You remain in a hydrodynamic phase. So let me tell you now about the Bjorkane hydrodynamics. So in hydrodynamics, the full stress tensor is expressed in terms of the temperature, velocity, and their gradients. And the key observation for most of this work to actually work or to be feasible is that in Bjorkane flow, the velocity is fixed by the symmetries of the problem, right? The velocity is not dynamical, it's kinematic, right? It's fixed by the symmetries, and it takes this particular form. And now if we come back and look at the metric that is expressed in proper time and the so-called rapidity coordinate, you see that this metric, although it's a flat space, this is a curvilinear metric written in curvilinear coordinates, so that implies that there will be non-trivial Christoffel symbols associated with this choice of coordinates. And then the gradients of velocity will come entirely from Christoffel symbols. And if you work out the Christoffel symbols, you will find out that the Christoffel symbols are proportional to 1 over tau. So that is an indication that in Bjorkane flow, hydrodynamic gradient expansion actually is equivalent to late time power series. So at very late times, at asymptotically late times, you expect your system to isotropize, right? You expect that if you wait for long enough, your plasma, although it was anisotropic, will become completely isotropic. And now if you look at the form of the stress tensor, that means that you have to equal this entry, this component to this component. And if you do this, you obtain a simple first order differential equation for the energy density that you can trivially integrate. And you obtain that the energy density scales like 1 over tau to 4/3. And now if you make use that the energy density is proportional to the temperature to the fourth power, you obtain the scaling of the temperature as 1 over tau to 1/3. So basically, the take-home message from this is that this is expanding medium that dilutes during the evolution process. And if you look at the form of the hydrodynamic stress tensor, in holographic hydrodynamics, the gradient expansion parameter is the gradient of velocity, right? So it's 1 over tau multiplied by 1 over the temperature. And now if you take this calculation and this calculation together, you obtain that for the Bjorkane flow, this gradient expansion parameter is 1 over tau to 2/3. So the structure that you expect to appear is overall scaling like 1 over tau to 4/3. And then you'll see gradient corrections, that each gradient correction comes with a power of 1 over 2/3. So this is the leading order term is a perfect fluid solution. The subleading term cares about first gradient correction, which is associated with the shear viscosity because we are doing conformal field theories. A second order term cares about a second order transport coefficients, and so on and so forth. What I want to stress is that the form of these coefficients is explicitly known due to gravity calculations at low order of gradient expansion. And these are basically pure numbers multiplied by a constant that I denote by lambda that denotes the overall scale that is set by the initial conditions for hydrodynamics. So the task for some part of this talk is to obtain the form of these coefficients for much larger n, right? Like, so not for 2, 3, 4, but actually for 240 or something of that order. And we're gonna use the gravity to achieve this task. So hence I have to describe what is the gravity dual to the Bjorkane flow. Any questions so far? No. Okay, so the symmetries of the flow that is characterized by this form of the stress tensor lead to the following ansatz for the dual metric. So we have in this ansatz, we have tau that is ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein time coordinates. And apart from this, we have three different warp factors that might be thought of as following from three different components of the stress tensor. And now, if you derive Einstein's equations, what we're going to find is that there are five non-trivial equations for three functions of two variables, so two of these equations are constrained. One thing to note is that this metric ansatz that I adopted here, that uses ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, has a residual diffeomorphic freedom that will be useful in how we derived the form of the stress tensor. So, naively, if one solves those equations, so equations of motion following from Einstein's equations for this metric ansatz, as the initial value problem, then one needs to know these functions A, sigma, and B as a function of the radius on the initial time slice. Of course, there are constraints, so it's slightly more complicated, but let me not dwell into details. Let me stress that such way of formulating the problem typically leads to far from equilibrium physics, right? In stark contrast with hydrodynamics, in this far from equilibrium physics, we have infinite number of degrees of freedom. How to see it? The initial value problem is specified as by providing a set of functions of radial variable, right? And a function has infinitely many parameters in it. So if we solve that way, typically we are providing information about infinite many degrees of freedom, and that's in stark contrast with hydrodynamics, where we have only 4 degrees of freedom, the velocity and temperature. And the process of hydrodynamization that I will tell you about on the next transparency is a nonlinear relaxation from the infinite number of degrees of freedom to 4 degrees of freedom. So as I told you before, for hydrodynamics to work, all the other degrees of freedom need to relax. But when I say so, it doesn't mean that I constrain myself to be in the regime of parametrically small gradients, right? It might be that I need to be in such a regime, but it might not. So what I'm plotting here is a comparison between the result of the full evolution of Einstein's equation, right? So full microscopic theory with all the degrees of freedom that are there in a system versus the prediction given by first order, so viscous hydrodynamics, the simplest non-trivial theory that we can write down. I'm plotting the quantity that would be a trace of the stress tensor if we were in equilibrium. I'm taking a derivative of the energy density minus 3 times pressure. But a priori, our system is anisotropic. It has 2 different pressures, one in the longitudinal direction, the other in the transversal direction. So by taking this combination, I obtain 0 only if I relax to a state that is thermal, right? And I'm plotting this quantity as a function of time. And what you see here is that the curve given by the full evolution, no assumptions whatsoever, matches the curve given by first order viscous hydrodynamics in the regime where the system is highly anisotropic, right? The anisotropy of the stress tensor can be of order of 0.6 to 1 times the energy density. So that's a really huge anisotropy. Hence, in our community, the approach to hydrodynamics is strongly distinguished from the isotropization or thermalization that happens not here, but actually it happens somewhere here. Like also it might happen like an order of magnitude later than hydrodynamics starts to work. That's something that is very non-trivial, and actually it's interesting from the point of view of heavy ion collisions and experiments and phenomenology. So what I'm showing you is a plot of the energy density of nuclear matter created in a collision after about 0.4 femtometer per C after the collision, which is roughly the time that people start hydrodynamic evolutions for various reasons. This is the transversal profile, so these are the transversal coordinates. So what we see here is that the radius of this is roughly 10 femtometers. So that's basically the radius of the lat or or gold nuclei. But the interesting thing to see is that because these nuclei, the colliding nuclei, are quantum objects, they widely fluctuate, and these fluctuations leave an imprint of the nuclear matter they create. And actually, if you look at this plot taken from this experimental paper, or phenological paper, what you're going to see is that the gradients, these say yellow or orange dots, are exactly of order that I showed you here. So despite such large gradients, nuclear theorists still use hydro and do well in describing data, but they have no guidance why this is a good thing to do, why this is the right thing to do. And the discovery of the phenomenon of hydrodynamization that I showed you on the last transparency suggests that doing such a thing might not be theoretically outrageous. So if 2 months ago, I was at the nuclear theory conference in Spain, and I was talking with Matt Luzum, who is one of the nuclear theorists doing numerical simulations, and he was very astonished that holography can provide us with justification for actually doing this, because that was something that from the point of view of heavy ion community, might be regarded to some extent that as being theoretically outrageous. But there are other systems, there are holographic gate theories, in which actually such things can be described successfully with hydrodynamics, and that's not entirely a bad idea. So good. So that was the phenomenon of hydrodynamization that required the full solution of Einstein's equation. So let me come back and stay in the near equilibrium regime for the rest of my talk. So now we want to solve Einstein's equations in this pre-equilibrium regime. So this is the form of the hydrodynamic energy density that we expect. And actually, this thing predating the fluid gravity duality suggests the form of the dual metric ansatz. So the starting point, because the starting point is this piece that corresponds to a thing that is locally equilibrated and thermalized, suggests to take a locally boosted black brain. So we take a black brain solution and we associate the temperature with this temperature and velocity, so the boost parameter with the velocity of the flow. So that's the leading order term. And now gradient expansion will be thus encoded as 1 over tau to 2/3 expansion in such a way that we keep the product of radial distance and a temperature fixed. So that means that we measure the radial position with respect to the thermal length scale.
Logs of this?
Yeah, they can be, but they're not.
They're not.
How are they not?
Because you can do the expansion for this is a conformal field theory, right?
Mm-hmm. But they can still be log terms. Once things become time dependent, which is what it is in the evolution, they can still be.
No, you don't need logs. I mean, you can go through the near boundary expansion, order by order, and you can show the arbitrary high order that there are no logs.
No, it's
not 5D. So it's 5D conformal field theory living in the background.
It blocks 5D, so you would expect logs.
No. You would expect logs if you put it in a curved background, but it's not curved.
No, but it is.
It's time dependent, but it's not curved.
No, but it, because it is. I see. So you're saying that because they. The four-dimensional slices are always flat.
Yeah.
But are they flat?
No, they're not flat. They're not flat.
If they are not flat, then there could be logs because there is a conformal anomaly in
any two points. But the conformal anomaly is a thing that comes from putting a theory on a curved manifold, right?
No,
but
effectively, it's only one direction, right?
Only one weird coordinate says a.
Yeah. But the metric overall.
So
is
I don't
flat.
Think that'll show up.
No.
I think conformal will benefit.
The reason I'm not making a statement, I'm just asking. I know example where, you know, if you look at the static solutions, there are no logs, and once you allow the the sources become dependent, then the logs will appear.
Oh, sure. In general, sure.
Right. So in this case, I guess you're saying that when you carefully do the analysis, you will find out that there are no logs.
So you find out that there are no logs, and the other way to think about this is, you know, the thing lives in a flat space, right? So I wrote the flat space in curvilinear coordinates, but I can also write the flat space in Cartesian coordinates, right? And then I do the calculation, there are no logs whatsoever, and then in the end, I transform the solution into curvilinear coordinates again, and I generate no logs whatsoever.
Which is true
in the standard cases. Oh, let me tell you, there are no logs here.
Okay, yeah, no, that's rejected.
No.
That I like.
I think we also work on this, and there are no logs there.
I mean, I know that to some like thousands or four thirds there are no logs, but I wouldn't know right away that there are no logs at higher order.
Joel's final question.
Oh yeah, I was just going to ask you, the fluid solution you have, is it, what equations are you solving? Is that like the hydro equations, to what order, or what with what transport?
You're asking about this? Okay, so that's the general form that I anticipate. But then, in order to generate these terms, epsilon 2, epsilon 3, epsilon 4, I need to know the microscopics. So this microscopics is known up to this point. And then all the rest, you have to regenerate again using gravity. So my point is to tell you how to solve it so that you generate all the rest of these tags. Yeah, good. Yeah. So to recap, we'll be solving equations in which the warp factors are expanded in a gradient expansion, and each term in the expansion does not depend on the radius and time independently. It depends on this particular combination that means measuring the radial position with respect to the thermal landscape. So actually, my point is that in the end, we're gonna solve just ODEs. So at each order of the gradient expansion, we need to solve a set of linear inhomogeneous ODEs in the variable that I denote by V. And the structure of these equations is iterative. And the only difficulty comes in calculating the inhomogeneous terms, right? Comes from calculating sources. So we fix the units by setting a particular normalization of the temperature. We can always do this. We are in a conformal field theory, so we can reproduce any other result by doing dilatation. And we have a residual diffeomorphism in our metric, so we can always put one of these warp factors to be equal to zero at a particular radial position. It turns out that's a crucial thing to do. And then we solve three differential equations. We have five in total, and we use the two others to provide the boundary conditions, roughly speaking, at the event horizon, right? We impose the regularity where the event horizon is, and we demand that we are considering a field theory living in a flat boundary, right? So we have a fluid that expands by itself, is not forced by any means. The way we obtain the solution, we discretize the V direction spectrally and use a pseudospectral method and matrix inversion to solve these ODEs. And the energy density that we are looking for, so these coefficients are encoded in the behavior of one of the functions near the boundary. So far, so good. To achieve the accuracy we wanted, we used 251 grid points and kept 450 digits to resolve high order contributions. If we didn't do this, then the calculation breaks down. From some moment onwards, we got meaningless results. And the calculation in Mathematica up to order 240 took 4 weeks on a desktop, on a very, very powerful desktop machine. So we did it, and we obtained this plot. So this is roughly speaking the order of the gradient expansion, right? We went up to order 240. We aimed at 250, but then it took basically one day to go forward in time and to forward to the next order, and we wanted to finish the paper, so we didn't go to all the way to 250. And then what I'm plotting here is a ratio of the coefficients we got normalized to the leading order to the perfect fluid prediction. And for reasons that I will explain in a second, I take like I raise this to a power of 1 over n. So what I observe here is that at low orders, so here, there is nothing interesting going on. The behavior is not irregular, it's something. But from a certain moment onwards, so from roughly 10th order, we start observing a factorial growth of subsequent contributions. So this plot is a first evidence that hydrodynamic gradient expansion has a zero radius of convergence, because this factorial growth of subsequent contributions in a series is typically associated with the zero radius of convergence. So that's a numerical evidence. So you may say that you're not buying this because you're concerned about numerical accuracy. Maybe you made a mistake. Maybe it's not generic, blah, blah, blah. So somehow I have to convince you, actually, that this makes sense. In particular, convince you that we didn't make any mistake. So, if you any questions about this plot? Yeah.
Just remind me, going, what were the initial conditions? We were starting with an expansion at late times, or solving inwards in quantity regular times, or just remind me again, what's the sort of initial conditions you
used? So it's not an initial volume problem then. It's an elliptic problem.
Yes. So what was the
So the starting point is the perfect is the boosted Lagrange solution.
Yeah.
And on top of this, you construct all the available gradient contributions. The difference between this and, say, your work is that we are not resolving different gradient contributions. So for example, epsilon 3 is a shear contribution. So there is only one transport coefficient that contributes to this. But for example, epsilon 4 is a second order contribution to which two different transport coefficients contribute, right? But we see it as a single number because we calculate this for a particular solution of hydro equations. So that's the difference. So we're doing exactly what you did with, say, Costas and collaborators, but we do this for a particular solution, and this allowed us to go to such a high order. Yeah? Good. Any other questions?
That's the boundary condition.
Everything is well false, yeah.
Okay.
We use the equations of motion to generate the, so some boundary conditions are trivial, so the UV boundary conditions are trivial because that's the flatness of the metric, and the non-trivial ones are the infrared boundary conditions, and in order to simplify the thing, we use what you would call constraint equations to provide these boundary conditions for two functions, and for the third one, you use this freedom of residual diffeomorphism, and like that's this boundary condition, and then that makes the problem well posed.
Somehow, okay. So remind me. So I saw that if you do it naively, then there will be a singularity, right?
But we
at small. Okay.
No, this is Eddington Finkelstein. There are no singularities whatsoever. There. So the whole point of using Eddington Finkelstein versus, say, Fefferman Graham is that there are no coordinate similarities. Yeah. Absolutely. Let me continue. So we saw this, and now we want to understand this better. So one thing to understand, if you worked with divergent series previously, one thing to understand is the slope of this curve. It turns out that the slope is a meaningful quantity. So the standard method for dealing with asymptotic series, so let me say the series with zero radius of convergence, is a technique of Borel transform and Borel summation. So I can explain you this technique in a very simple term. So suppose that you have such a series, right? This series has such a property that each term grows like n factorial, right? So what you can do is something very simple minded. You divide each term by corresponding n factorial. And then if you perform an integration, you can restore this n factorial again by doing the following integration. So the whole idea is that if you go through this series of steps, you do not change anything, provided you do this term by term. So this thing restores n factorial. So if you divide by n factorial and you restore it here, you end up with this expression. But obviously, we are not going to do this term by term, because this thing makes a difference if we can actually find an analytic continuation of this expression, right? Because if we have an analytic continuation of this expression, this analytic continuation can have certain pattern of singularities. And then depending on how we take this integral, because this is the integral on a complex plane, we can end up with a different result, right? So the idea here is to divide each term by n factorial and do an analytic continuation and look at what happens on a complex plane. That's a pretty standard way of dealing with such series that we learned about when we approach this problem. So the simplest thing that you can do is to use the Pada approximant. So this expression over here is called a Borel transform. It's denoted by B acting on a function, say the now epsilon. And we have 242 terms, actually, if you count carefully. And then, we have 241 terms. And then we represent the sum. So we have this expression only up to certain cutoff. We represent the sum that we have as a ratio of two polynomials. That's called the Pada approximation. And we treat this Pada approximant as a simple-minded analytic continuation of this. So you might say that. So what happens?
The work, they give you an excellent answer, but when you didn't get the weights correctly, they can give you complete nonsense. So how do you know that it should be symmetry at 120 on each side?
So it's a good point. So it's complicated, let's put it that way. When we were doing this project, we just took it, went with this to the end of calculation, and we found out that we get a reasonable result and that it provided the justification. And it turns out that you can do better by analyzing the behavior of this series at early times. I can tell you more in private, but there is a certain way that also is based on some approximations to know what ratio to take. And as far as I remember, this ratio then is not a ratio of polynomials of the same order, but this one has to have a bigger order, I think.
Well, it depends on the equality.
No, but let me go to the analytics structure, right? So that's the simplest-minded thing, the simple-minded thing to do. And now you have to check whether it makes sense or not, right? Like that's a bold assertion that this tells us anything about the analytic continuation. So these are so we have a ratio of two polynomials. So what matters, the singularities, the naive singularities would be the zeros of the denominator, right? But then it might happen that these zeros of the denominator coincides with the zeros of the numerator, and then there are no real singularities, right? So we have to plot both zeros of the denominator and numerator, and then after all decide which of them are true singularities and which of them are apparent singularities. So this is the plot. So this psi we're plotting the real and complex value of the imaginary value of the zero of each polynomial. So xi naught is just the zero. So what we see here are some singularities appearing on the real axis, on the negative part of the real axis. There is a zero of the numerator at the origin that we don't care about because it's not a singularity, right? And then what we see here are poles of the denominator that look like discretized branch cuts that start from certain particular value of this psi. And then if you look close at what are these numbers, it turns out that these zero are on top of each other with an amazing accuracy of 10 to minus 150. Whereas these others typically are not. So the claim is that we're going to remove from the plots these similarities because they're apparent. And we're going to keep those because they are real. Any questions? So we're doing everything. We're doing everything numerically. So we have to really make sure that we're not including things that are numerical artifacts in our problem. So this is the plot after removing apparent singularities of the Borel transform. So now, in order to restore n factorials, we have to take this integral. This is an integral that connects 0 and infinity. Borel transform is an argument, and then there are some factors appearing. However, there are singularities in the complex plane. So it depends, the answer that you're going to get depends on the contour that you take. One obvious contour that you might be tempted to take is to integrate all the way along the real axis, right? And that's one answer that you're going to get. The other answer that you might get is if you take this contour. Actually, because you want to get the answer that is a real function, probably you would have to take this contour and add this contour and take 1/2 or something of that sort. But nevertheless, let's take these two integrals, let's evaluate them, and let's check what's the difference, right? And it turns out that the difference between this answer and this answer is like this, where the frequency that we obtain here matches the up to a few digits, the frequency of the lowest non-hydrodynamic mode present in the system. So that's a highly non-trivial cross-check that what we are doing is correct in a sense that we can trust our numerics, and actually that indeed we should associate the zero radius of convergence of hydro with the existence of non-hydrodynamic degrees of freedom in a liquid. So when we saw this, we thought that that's quite remarkable, but we can also push it farther to further test the accuracy and whether our approach makes sense. So if you look at this, you have this frequency, but there is a mysterious factor of 3/2 that we had to factor out, and there is some pre-exponential factor that clearly is not there for regular quasi-normal modes that you would like to understand. And it turns out that you can do this. So in the following, I will tell you how to understand this and how to understand this. Any question about it? Okay. So we have this structure that we recovered from taking the integral in two different ways. And the first thing to understand is whether this 3/2 here that multiplies the frequency of the quasi-normal mode makes sense. And it makes sense because this quasi-normal mode here is a fast evolving mode, not on top of a static plasma, but on top of a background that is slowly changing in time. So in the local rest frame, as it turns out to be the case here, at the leading order, this expression cares only about the temperature. But the temperature is time dependent. It's not changing exponentially with time. It's changing in a polynomial way. It's changing like 1/(tau)^(1/3). So now imagine solving a harmonic oscillator in which the frequency depends on time, albeit in a much more milder way than the evolution of the harmonic oscillator itself. So now, if we solve this equation to the lowest to the leading order in derivatives of omega, the solution will be the following. So actually, that way of solving the equations is exactly the same as you want to think about quasi-neural modes on top of the slowly evolving plasma. So we have to integrate over time. We have to put there the frequency of the quasi-neural mode. There is some factor that follows from the normalization that Kovtun and Starinets chosen, so I don't want to dwell into details of this. And then we have to put how the temperature, because the temperature sets the scale of the mode, how the temperature depends on time. And because we have to integrate over time, 1/tau to 1/3, actually this integral generates for us this 3/2 and the way that the mode depends on time. And that's also another interesting thing that you can observe at this level. This contribution is exponentially dampened in time, and this dampening rate is proportional to 1/tau to 2/3. But 1/tau to 2/3 is how the gradients contribute, right? So my statement is that the coupling constant, if we were to make an analogy with a quantum field theory, the coupling constant is 1/tau to 2/3, because that's the gradient expansion parameter. And this contribution that we recovered goes like 1 to the minus 1/g^(mL²). Let me put it like this, which is 2 minus 1/tau to 2/3. So what I want to say is that from the perspective of hydrodynamics, these non-hydrodynamic quasi-normal modes act exactly like instanton-like degrees of freedom, instanton-like degrees of freedom in quantum field theory. It turns out, I don't want to dwell into details because I'm running out of time, that you can also understand this power appearing here by looking how this integral behaves. Let me skip it. And you can make the match up to 1/3 or 1/4 decimal place. How you compute alpha? This one or this one? The gravity one. Oh, okay. So this alpha comes from viscous corrections to the fluid gravity duality scenario. So I compute these modes, and I compute also. So as a background, I don't take the locally boosted black brain, but I take locally boosted black brain plus the viscous correction. And when I calculate the mode, I also include in the mode the correction from viscosity. Yeah.
So that's quite a normal mode on
the exactly. Yeah. And you can keep going and you can calculate subleading terms, but we didn't care. Very good. So any questions about this part of the talk? Nothing. So let me conclude. So one speculation and one obvious question that you can ask is what is the technical reason why hydrodynamic series is asymptotic? A famous example of asymptotic series expansion is a perturbative quantum field theory. And there are two things happening. One thing is that the number of Feynman graphs grow factorially at large orders. And the second thing that might be happening is that at certain orders, there are graphs that contribute with very big contributions, with like single graph gives you like n factorial. So there are basically two reasons. And we suspect that a similar mechanism to this also work in the case of hydrodynamics. So this is the general form of the stress tensor that you expect in hydrodynamics. This is the perfect fluid term. This is the viscous term. There is one available gradient correction. Then you go to the second order. There are already 5 available transport coefficients. So my claim is that hydro might be asymptotic series precisely because the number of transport contributions grow factorially with order. So if you include the high enough number of different gradient contributions, like including high enough order of Feynman graphs, then you recover exactly factorial behavior. That's pure conjecture. We don't know whether this is the case, but that's something that I would like you to keep in mind as a possibility. Yeah. Then the question is how it grows with time. We don't know. Yeah. You might also ask the question about the relevance of this. I won't dwell into details because Luis is looking at watch quite frequently. The only thing that I want to take home is that you can look at this singularities in the complex plane as a guidance for constructing hydrodynamic theory beyond naive gradient expansion. And such a hydrodynamic theory might work in the regime where if you take first, second, and third order hydrodynamics, you get a different answer. Nevertheless, your resound hydrodynamics can give you one answer that is the right answer. I won't dwell into details, that's the work in progress. So let me summarize by saying simply that hydrodynamics is an asymptotic series because in this fluid, in N equal 4 spraying wheels fluid, and I believe in any fluid, there are degrees of freedom that are not captured by hydrodynamic approximation. Thanks.
We know that from their work by other friends that there are actually issues even in the second order hydrodynamic coefficients once we go away from the margin.
Like what?
Well, they just become they become divergent. So this is a story of Pavel Kovtun and Gaibu and company, where they take into account long tails. So those are the corrections which show up as one by n correction, so they are invisible in this framework. But precisely those are the coefficients which, in case of 2 plus 1 dimensional hydrodynamics, the shear viscosity is not well defined. That was their conclusion. In 3 plus 1, in your case, the shear viscosity of the first order hydrodynamics is well defined. But the second order hydrodynamic coefficient has the same problem as a shear viscosity in lower dimension. It's related with one over n effect. So it's a subtle story. How do you take a hydrodynamic limit, basically k goes to zero versus n goes to infinity limit. So as far as practical application of this, but that's okay.
So you're saying that this might have a limited regime of validity?
No, I'm not saying. I'm just saying that there are other things. There are other things that if we sort of try to take this and say, what does that tell us about the real world? So that's one story, that in the hydrodynamics there will be non-hydrodynamic mode. And so that will have, as you showed, that would have an impact on the expansion. But the thing is that the problem starts, what I'm saying is that the problem starts even earlier, and those are the problems associated with, if you think in terms of hydrodynamics as an effective field series, there would be hydrodynamic loops. And so those are the things that would spoil.
I haven't thought about it, so I cannot comment. Yeah, I know what paper you're talking about, but I haven't thought about how to resolve this issue. The only thing that I might show you is that you can consider Israel Stewart theory that is familiar to astrophysicists here, and you can make a very similar like analog of a plot that I showed you for n equals 4. And then what you're going to find is that there in Israel Stewart theory is not hydro. It's a theory that have also non-hydrodynamic degrees of freedom. There is a mode that is exponentially dampened with time. And if you go to the complex plane by repeating the story that I told you, you will see that there is a branch cut that goes along the real axis, that and this branch cut starts exactly where the frequency of this exponentially decaying mode is. So it seems that the story that I showed you works also outside n equal 4, because you can take Israel Stewart theory with arbitrary transport coefficient as a phenomenological model. Let me close with this. Thanks.
Because I mean, what he said is that these long time tails are suppressed.
No, that's a classical theory. That's a classical theory.
But if there's one over n corrections, then all of this is not really. We know that hydrodynamics cannot be expanded.
Let me not dwell into this because I don't know how to resolve this, and it seems to me that you don't know how to resolve this either.
Okay. Resolve what?
The issue of that Guy Moore and Corbett solved, right?
It's a effect.
I mean, this is known from the 70s.
That's right.
Long-time tails. So Kapton only sort of rediscovered this in context of holography, but this is a known phenomenon.
It's not like it's...
Is it experimental?
It is.
Is it experimentally relevant?
Yeah, so numerically you can do experiments and you see these long-time decay of correlation functions of conserved quantities like stresses. So this is a known fact.
I would still say that it doesn't necessarily have to be the case. It could have been that the series has a finite radius of convergence, and the radius of convergence is given by the first quasi-normal model.
But you see here that it's not the case.
I know that I see here that it's not the case, and so I'm saying if I have 1 divided 1 minus s, okay, so I'm doing a Taylor series expansion of that. I see a series, it just happens that that series has a finite radius of convergence where there is a pole. So if I use this naive analogy and I look at the stress energy tensor, so there are poles in the stress energy tensor correlation functions, and the poles in the stress energy tensor will show up where I have physical excitation.
Sure.
So typical physical excitations are the hydrodynamic modes, which I'm completely taking into account. And the next one that I'm not taking into account is the massive one. That's why I keep pushing.
Well, very good, but I think that the assumption that you make is that you know exactly the form of hydrodynamic modes. No. That's important.
I know that shear and sound.
But you know them in the gradient expansion. That's my whole point.
No. That's fine. I mean, the gradient expansions are really, it's like 1/x. I can do an infinite series. The thing that probably the field theories are more complicated in this regard than just Taylor series as I'm talking about. Or at least looking at the because there is a gap in the system, and so I see no reason why if I have a gap in the system, at least I can come up with the toy models where I look in the physics below the gap, and it will be completely captured by my light degrees of freedom. I take into account all the light degrees of freedom, it's a shear and sound. That there is nothing else that is black. The mode that you reveal is not the mode that I mistakenly left out.
My answer to this would be just that if you take and resum this series, then maybe you're right. But my point is that as long as you look at hydrodynamics in gradient expansion, then you run into problem.
What I'm saying is that, seriously speaking, I didn't even have to resum. In the simple calculus examples, I don't usually have to resum. But it looks like the field theories are more complicated, and so they show up that
I don't agree. But we can discuss afterwards.
That's right.
But I think what you're talking about is suppose that I do this Borel summation and I get some answer that
Well, what I kept pushing is that why did I have to do Borel resummation at all? Why would it have been the case that hydrodynamics is a finite radius of convergence, and it simply tells me that I have precisely like 1/x in a complex plane. It just simply tells me that where the radius of convergence is to the closest singularity. So from the perspective of the
My claim is that in some sense you're right.
I don't want to be right because that contradicts
that doesn't contradict. Like, that's why I want to say this. Yeah. So let me find the right plot. Yeah, that's the plot. So suppose you look at this, right? So that's the prediction of hydrodynamic theory that is given by low order hydrodynamics, right? So then you might say that perhaps if you go along this gray curve, that's a resummed hydrodynamics, right? Because it's not given by the gray curve is not given in a gradient expansion. It's an exact result, right? And then indeed, this exact result applies after a time scale, the lowest non-hydrodynamic degree of freedom relaxes, right? Like in 1/T. So in this sense, Alex is right. But my statement is that if you try to predict the shape of this exact result by doing gradient expansion, then you run in trouble. So that's my point, then you run in trouble.
I'm not questioning your result. I'm just saying
that, I tried to explain your confusion, but let's discuss after.
Yeah, okay. Just one more thing. So Michal is here till tomorrow afternoon. So let's thank him again.